For today's discussion, an appeal intended as rational for a little less appalling rationalization.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
As you know, if you listen to these episodes on a regular basis, I have gone through everything from catharsis to transformation over the past decade, 20 years. And, you know, it's one that has to happen. If we're going to be followers of Jesus, we're supposed to change. We're supposed to grow. And so I have. And in a lot of ways, I've recognized the errors of my way or the error of my ways. It actually is the errors of my way. I've been a follower since I was 9 years old. I've been adamantly committed to following Christ since I was 16 years old. And in that process, I also spent a lot of time in debate and a lot of other, you know, public speaking efforts that shaped my way of understanding how to not just win an argument, but how to make my point so that everyone else could understand the truth that I believed in and so on. And it was sincere. I mean, I believed it. But I also believed that no matter what I believed and no matter how much evidence was contrary to it, I could win the argument. I could win the argument for a lot of different reasons. And it was part of the skill that you, I mean, that inherently is part of the skill you develop as a debater. When I was a debater, you receive, and this is the case today, and I did policy debate as they refer to it today or whatever. It's not about me and debate and biography. It's not that. I want to get down to reasoning and rationalization in just a second. But I just want to share with you why I see this. I see it because it's part of my background. And because of that, it's probably like parents are with their own kids when they cannot stand one of their kids because they're so obnoxious about this or that. And it's all of the rest of us can see as clear as day. It's because that kid is the most like them. The things that we are able to discern about our children are obviously clearer and more obvious if we knew they were true about us to begin with. So that kid's not getting away with anything. They're just walking through the steps you already walked through. Well, that's how I feel about a lot of the argumentation that I hear today. It's not neutral for me. It's not like, oh, well, they've got a point and I have a point and I wonder which one's right. It's not that. There's plenty of that in my life and I've got plenty of room to grow. But I also have come from somewhere. And so when I look back and I see people standing where I stood and doing the same thing that I did to their own disadvantage, to their own harm, and to the harm of our society, then I want to say, let me explain something to you, my child. And I realize they're not all children, and they're not all my child, and I don't have responsibility for them. So I don't have the prerogative of judging or condemning, but I do have the option, the opportunity to try to help. And so that's what I want to do. And the topic that I've given today of reasoning and rationalization, obviously the two words should mean the same thing. The definition behind them doesn't mean the same thing, but their root means they should be the same thing. Reasoning on the one side and rationalization on the other, with reasoning on the one side, it's pretty simple. It's having sufficient justification in order to make a judgment. You know, do you know enough to draw the conclusion that you've drawn? And when we say, and you, if you just think about it, you'll realize how obvious this is. When we say someone is unreasonable, when we're saying, oh, you're being irrational, what we mean is they're appealing to, on one side, emotion, and there are other things than these two options I'll give you, but But I'll give you a couple of examples. One is emotion. The other is compulsion. On the emotion example, we're saying, oh, you're being all emotional. Men do this to women all the time, unfairly and inaccurately, by the way. At other times, maybe not entirely inaccurately, but it's not about the gender. Anyway, the point is, men do this all the time, and it's not always accurate when we're saying it. But it can be that we could say to someone, look, you're not being rational. You are afraid of a certain circumstance. So fear is one of the emotions that drives judgment making that's not rational. Anger is another emotion that does the same thing. Fear. I've told you the story about when, and I say this, I've told you, if you happen to listen to the episode when I talked about this a billion years ago, which I wouldn't expect you to remember even if you did. I used to keep bees. And when I kept bees, I went out to the hives one day, and one of the hives was really angry about something, and they were just buzzing all around me. And no problem, I've got my bee suit on. I'm not one of these guys that goes out there with no gloves and no hat and just says, oh, I'm cool, I don't mind a few stings. I don't like to be stung once. I don't like any of that. And so anyway, I'm going out to take care of the bees. They're attacking my suit. I don't know why they're so angry. This is kind of a mean hive. I had two hives. One of the hives was really mean. I did this with my son-in-law, Jonathan. And so anyway, when I went out there, I was by myself this time, partially because he had been stung and he had a bad reaction to it and had to go off to the hospital. And instead of taking care of my son-in-law, I thought I should go take care of the honey. Maybe I'll rethink that next time. Sorry about that, Jonathan. Anyway, the point is, I get to the hive. I do my business, take care of the, you know, all the stuff that I need to do with the hive, close it back up, and I'm walking away, and a bee bumps into my face. Now, you know, I have on a bee bonnet. You know, I've got on the cover, the net that covers your whole head. Nothing should touch my face. So a bee bumping into me means I have a bee in my bonnet, as people say. That's the joke, you know, or at least the idiom, the expression that we use. And when you have a bee in your bonnet, I'm telling you, the thing that mattered was there were 10,000 bees outside of my suit that wanted to sting me and kill me, but they couldn't get to me. But one bee could, and it kept bumping into me. It went up my nose one time, and I had to snoot it out, you know, snort it out, I guess I should say. Doesn't matter. When the bee is in your hat, you don't care if you're snooting or snorting. You're just doing whatever you got to do. It's the same thing when it bumped into my eyeball, literally bumped into my eyeball. Fortunately, in all of this, it had not stung me. I could not believe it. So I'm clearing out and running, trying to get back to my truck. I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but at the end of it, here's the reality. I still had a bunch of bees swarming around me when it's like, nope, can't do it anymore. I got to take this hat off. This bee cannot go up my nose again. I cannot do that again. And so I took my hat off and I ran from them and I found a hose and I was able to spray them. And once you get them wet, they don't care about anything. It's like, oh, a bath. We don't care. Anyway, it was all fine. My point is, it's completely irrational to take off your protective bee suit when you have 10,000 bees that can kill you outside of the suit and one bee in the suit that will not kill you. It'll just be unpleasant for a moment. I took my hat off because I wasn't being rational, right? That's an irrational. It is irrational. And a lot of times we're not rational beings. We behave in a different way. And yet it's important for us not always to be that way. I'll make the case for why we should be rational in a minute. But by definition, being rational means you have sufficient justification for the judgment that you're making. And it's irrational to make judgments that are based purely on emotion or like fear. In a less significant example, I used to do this when it was heavy rain. I would think, oh, I got to get out to my car and I got to get on the road because this rain is just, you know, it's not until you're older that you realize the rain's going to be hard for 5 minutes and then it's going to assuage and everything's going to be fine. And you can just walk out to your car and not even get wet. I got soaked a bunch of times before I learned that lesson and became more rational about my judgments. In anger, people do the same thing. Juries convict people because they're so angry about what happened. The history of America has plenty of this in racial terms. But on a jury in which I served, we had jurors that wanted to convict a person, not for a bad reason, just not for a rational one, not for good grounding, but for an emotional one, because they felt terrible for the victims. Look, these victims really suffered, they would say. You can't just let this guy off. even when they knew the evidence did not indicate that he had done the crime. They were, and we didn't end up, you know, convicting on that crime. It was all fine. I'm telling you, we made the case and they came around. But the reality is we can make our judgments on irrational principles instead of rational ones, and it affects us. Compulsion does the same thing. When somebody's got a bad habit, when somebody's addicted to something, you can say to them all day long, you know, you probably shouldn't do that. Here are the disadvantages that go with that. Here's your brain on drugs, you know, and show them a fried egg. And it's not going to make any difference to them. They're not making the judgment on a rational basis. There is a compulsion there that has more force with them than you would expect. And so, and it's important for us to learn to live within that reason. The reason it's so important, for instance, one of the reasons it's so important to be rational, to justify reasoning, we're still on the definition side of reasoning, is that you have to make, for example, plans for a crisis before you're in the crisis. You have to establish good patterns for reasoning during the times when you know you're probably not going to exercise good patterns of reasoning. So you make the decision before the fear comes. You make the decision before the Boggy Creek monster is outside your cabin, you know, that kind of stuff. For those of you who are my age, you know what I'm talking about. So it's the same as establishing good patterns. This is the point of the conversation today. It's what I want us to do, establish good patterns for reasoning and good tools for evaluating our own reasoning before the times when we want to believe something so badly. We have a desired outcome that's so important that it might overtake our ability to be cautiously judicious, to be deliberate and intentional about the way we think of it. I've heard lately people, and it's easy to hear people do stuff like this, right? Because there's social media. And social media highlights all the dumbest things that people can say, because those are the things that create clickbait. And so we pursue that, and then we think that represents the rest of the world. I don't think that. I don't think these people represent the rest of the world. I just want to give you an example, because I've seen this from people who are perfectly intelligent and in fact, have great intelligence, but don't display it when it comes down to something they really want to prove, they really want to be able to say, and they really want to convince us that they have good justification for it. And so, for instance, I've heard perfectly intelligent people make ludicrously circular arguments, circular reasoning to justify their claim, because they're so convinced that the point they want to make is obvious. Now, listen. I'm not an LGBTQ advocate. Our school has a very clear statement and position on gender and sexuality, and I uphold that, and I stand with it. That doesn't make every single argument that people make against the LGBTQ movement or the things that they do rational. And that's an important point, too, that not everything somebody who's wrong says has to be wrong. They can be right about things as well. And so here's an example of somebody who I probably agree with on the overall issue, but absolutely wrong on this. So, for instance, this guy was attacking. I'm not going to say who it was, not going to create a link. I'm not trying to embarrass anybody, and I certainly don't want to draw attention to poor reasoning. Well, I mean, except when I'm talking about it in this case. Anyway, the point, that was kind of poor reasoning, wasn't it? Anyway, the point is, he's attacking Pride Month. He's saying, oh, it's terrible to have Pride Month. Pride is such a terrible term. I mean, he might as well name it Arrogance Month, something like that. He wasn't saying exactly those terms, but making that point. You know, well, it's a terrible thing. It's Pride Month. And he knows all the while, and he actually has to pause and parenthetically sort of explain this part, but he explains it in such a poor way that I know he knows he was creating a straw man so that he could just get to the conclusion he wanted to get to again. Talk about a straw man in a second. So all the while, he's saying, well, you know, I know it's the word they use, pride. They don't really mean pride, they say, but instead they mean we're recovering our identity and standing up for the identity that we've recovered. And then he goes on to attack them about finding their identity sexually. Now, that's an inauthentic critique. I understand why somebody might hold it, but this guy is smarter than that. And the truth is that if he wanted to be honest about saying, I don't like the name Pride, they should have used a different name instead of Pride, and they're finding their identity sexual, that's all they're finding. He should have been willing to admit that that's not the case at all. If he wants to address the naming of the event, then he should think through the best of their arguments, not the weakest of their arguments. When you pick out somebody's weakest argument or the weakest position they could be in and then attack that, you're just attacking a straw man. You know the argument. You know the case where you just make them look like they believe something they don't believe and then attack that and pretend like you've defeated them in the argument. If he had done, out of respect, what he should have done, which is say, now, why are they doing that? They can't just really think they live for sex every moment of every day. And they're not just trying to get up and say, look how arrogant we are. We're so obnoxious we can lord it over all of you. If they're not doing that, then what might they be doing? And he would know, because this is obvious, that it's not about identity. It's about dignity. And that term doesn't bother us. We believe in human dignity. That whether they're gay or not, they just want to be recognized as having equal dignity with everyone else. And the funny thing here is that, you know, everyone who hears me say that is going to think, oh, he's defending Pride Month, because I understand their argument. I don't have to agree with someone in order to understand them. I don't have to agree with them about all of their positions or why they want to live the life that they want to live or agree that that should be this way in the law or that way in the law. I don't have to agree with any of that to be able to understand where they're coming from and then have a legitimate discussion with them about what I do think, not just what's wrong with the word pride or something like that. And I don't have to agree with them to know that attacking a straw man may make for powerfully manipulative rhetoric on the other side, but also that that's not my only goal. And if that is my only goal, I should stop pretending to be acting rationally and just admit that sober-mindedness for me, you know, the biblical term that we use a lot of times for maintaining this kind of sobriety in our thinking, that it's really not all that valuable to me. I just want to win the argument. I don't really care about the truth. That's what I should admit. If all I want to do is attack straw men and win the argument publicly, I think we should do better than that. That is, I should admit, if I'm going to be like that, that I'm just out to win, that I'm utilitarian in my ethic. And that's a real insult for those of you who don't know the word, by the way. Wham. Okay. And that I don't really believe truth is all that important to God. But I do. And it, you know, when it hit me that I was compromising that truth to make points that I thought were somehow in defense of him, I realized I was not reasoning anymore. I was rationalizing. And that's an insult too. And by rationalizing, I mean not creating sufficient justification for the judgments we're going to make, but creating sufficient justification for the judgment I've already made. It goes backwards when you're rationalizing. And in this case, sufficient means something a little bit different. I mean, sufficiency is a broad and vague term, admittedly. It's got a lot of different weight to it. But it doesn't mean the same thing for rationalizing as it does for reasoning. For reasoning, sufficient means providing authentic warrant for a decision or a judgment. For rationalizing, sufficient simply means providing enough cover so that we or others won't question our judgment or won't be able to show what's wrong with it. It doesn't matter how we get there. We just want to make sure we got there. It's comparable in a lot of ways to what I have quoted before on a previous episode from Paul Ramsey, a really great quote that I learned when I was teaching bioethics and had read something from him. And he's a mid-20th century ethicist, bioethicist also. And he said, we must, on the occasion of evaluating, and this is, by the way, in the context of genetic controls, when we were experimenting, trying to do a lot with genetic control on the human species. And so there's a lot of questions that go with the ethics of that kind of behavior. And we're still trying to haggle all that out now, 50 years later. Anyway, he said, we must, on the occasion of evaluating whether to adopt certain technologies, raise the ethical question with a serious and not a frivolous conscience. A man of frivolous conscience announces that there are ethical quandaries ahead that we must urgently consider before the future catches up with us, by which he simply means we need to devise a new ethic so that we can provide rationalization for doing in the future what men are bound to do. Now, I'll stop the quote there because, you know, he gives the opposite half, which would actually be using reason to determine whether we ought to do a behavior or not. And that's why he draws the conclusion that a man of serious conscience, which I would equate in this or at least make parallel in this ethical statement with my statements about reasoning, I would say this is the man of serious conscience or serious thinking In contrast, a man of serious conscience means to say, in raising urgent ethical questions, that there may be some things that men should never do. The best part of the quote is this: the good things that men do can be made complete only by the things they refuse to do. Your belief in certain things can only really be justified by your reasoning if your belief in other things is something you're willing to let go of when sufficient reasoning is not there to justify it. If you can't let go of those other things, no one has any reason, including you, for believing the things you do that you provide may be just reasoning for. But who could know? Because you're willing to rationalize. I have done the same thing. I have lived there for so long. I don't want to be there anymore. And I've worked so hard not to be there. It grieves me when I look up and see how many of us are still living there right now. And so let me give you a couple of ways to think about this in terms of tools, a couple of them that are theoretical, and then the ones that actually come into application. So as we're talking through what I want to give you, which is five or six questions that are examples of what you can ask yourself to say, am I reasoning or rationalizing? You know, what am I doing here? Am I being honest with myself? So I have some questions that I hope you can ask yourself to see if they'll help. I don't think they're super simple, so it's not like you're going to memorize these and walk around asking yourself these questions. But it is something I hope will stick in your brain, will niggle at you when you have your ideas and start thinking through your arguments, and maybe invite you to be more honest with yourself, just as I have to do with myself, asking these same questions and sometimes finding uncomfortable answers. That's why I've ended up where I am on a lot of things, in a much more honest position, but also one I wouldn't have dreamed I would be in. Now, none of that has anything to do with my faith in Christ or my confidence in Scripture or the fact that I believe every word in the Bible and base my entire life on it. That's what I believe. But a lot of it that has to do with culture and cultural expectations and norms and where these patterns of behavior came from and whether we're defending something that's just because it's the way we like it or because God actually cares about it. And so, you know, what I mean by him caring, cares about everything, but you know what I mean, cares about us defending it. Okay, so the tools for consideration are these. On the theoretical side, it's criteria and testing. And by criteria, I'm not even going to use these words that often, but you should have these in your mind for thinking about how to do this. How do I think about whether my reasoning is correct or not? And the first thing we have to do is establish a criteria, which is just, or establish some criteria, which is just a standard. We have to establish some threshold of success. You know, if it were this, it would succeed. And if it were not, it would fail. So a threshold of success. So you set up a criteria, a basis for judgment. And then you have to have some test, some example or experience that provides information for comparing your outcomes with that criteria and seeing whether you cross the threshold or not, right? So you've got criteria and tests. And in all of that process, in real application, I think what it comes down to with reasoning and rationalization, if we want something to cross the threshold to be rational instead of simply rationalizing, then I think the criteria, the best, easiest, simplest, most unifying criteria would be consistency. Just consistency regarding whether we are being thoughtful, rational, level-headed, sober-minded, true, honest, you know, thinkers about an issue. I think the criteria we should lay down is consistency. Yeah, you can use whatever word you want to use for consistency, you know, being calculated. The etymology of reasoning and rationalization and rational and ratio are all the same. It's all the same word. It's calculating. It's being able to look at something and compare the parts and see how they fit together and make a sound judgment about it. It's being that, you know, having thought through it in those ways that are absolute. And that's what consistency is all about. We use the same method. We get the same outcomes no matter what we do. And so the questions that sort of go with that, not the big questions that I want to ask you, just the sort of underlying questions, the tests that go with that criteria of consistency, would be whether you can apply the same reasoning. Can you apply the same reasoning when the details change, when the context changes, when the subject matter changes? Does your way of seeing things hang together with all the other information you have? So really, in consistency, you've got this really basic meaning of that word. It applies everywhere all the time the same way. But then you've also got coherence, the idea that your way of seeing things fits everything together. It's not just exclusive to this one little example or case that you have in front of you. And so I want to give some questions that would invite our consideration of whether we are being consistent and whether we can apply our way of thinking to a coherent view of the world. And in order to get there, I want to first raise just this one other little side note. The examples I want to get to are political only because that's where we see the errors right now, because we're so divided, a mile of a canyon in between us, that if we hear anyone on the other side say anything, we're very sensitive to where they have rationalized away things that they should have taken into consideration and where their reasoning is not authentic. You know, we're all aware of that. And so we can see it in the politics, but I want to point out that it didn't begin with the politics. And so some of the examples I want to give aren't political. Some of them are political, but it is an invitation for us to decide whether we're actually reasoning anymore or if we're just rationalizing. And if we are, we really need to reconsider what we value and whether we actually care about the truth anymore or just want to stay where we are, because none of us have arrived at the truth yet. All of us have to work our way there, because as absolute, again, as the truth is, none of us are it by ourselves. We've got a long ways to go. So here's the thing. I've noticed these expressions of our thoughts about all kinds of things before we were doing these things with politics, or at least before it was most obvious when we were doing them with politics. But it is obvious now in the political world more than anywhere else. So let me give you some of the questions. Number one, are you starting with the result you want to get and then finding your way to a reason for it? If that's the case, and you heard me say this about rationalizing a moment ago, that's the definition of rationalizing instead of reasoning. If you already know the conclusion you want to draw and you're just trying to find some way to get there, then you're not reasoning anymore. I had a youth minister ages ago, I mean, almost 30 years ago now, and I was visiting with him on the way to Colorado one time, just driving, and you know, you have ages to drive and ages to talk. They were talking about everything, and he was a big fan of Bill Gothard. And so Bill Gothard, you know, he's the subject of that Shiny Happy People documentary. If you're the subject of a Shiny Happy People documentary, not good. You know, that's not good. And so I was a fan when I was 16 and 17 years old. But after that, I was never a fan of Bill Gothard. There was just something wrong, you know, with the whole thing, the whole premise, the whole way it was laid out. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all that. The point is, he wanted to promote Gothard with some of our youth. And he asked for permission to do it. I said, yeah, you can, but I don't want the youth group to be about that. It's not like you can't tell them what you believe. You can't share what you believe, but it can't be about them having to join the organization or go to the Institute and Basic Youth Conflict, which is what it was called back then, and so on. And so, and you know, he understood, and he was cooperative at that point. And so he said, well, why are you so hesitant about it? And I said, because it's a lot like a cult. You know, you have to believe everything. And the people who are in it don't even question the man. They don't question anything that he says. And he redefines terms and blah, blah, blah. I went on and on. And I said, so you just tell me, is there anything that you disagree with him about? Anything that you disagree with him about? He flat out said immediately, no hesitation, no, I agree with everything. I agree with everything. What? There's no point to continue the conversation at that point. Not because I'm like, oh, well, you're not intelligent. You have no mind. No, he has a mind, but he's already made it up. And no matter what you say at that point, it's like trying to reason. I'm not trying to be totally insulting, but I mean, this deserves an insult. It's like trying to reason with a flat earth person. When you're talking to someone who believes in a flat earth today, first of all, just stop. Just don't do it. But when you are, what you're talking with is who? What you're talking with? Who you're talking about depersonifying? Who you're talking with is a person who's already decided to discount so much obvious evidence in the world, so much of the common agreement that we have as human beings in the world, so much of the trust that it takes to exist in the world with other people in a society. There's no point at which you're going to talk them off the edge of their flat earth. They're just going to jump. There's nothing you can do about it. And it'll be okay because there's no real edge there. You're all right. Okay, so anyway, the point is, that example had nothing to do with politics, but it was obvious. And look, I have hesitations not about the discipline as a whole, but I have serious questions about a lot of incautious or utilitarian Christian apologetics. Not because the idea of apologetics is bad. I mean, it's a basic idea in Christianity. We respond when people say, well, what kind of a defense do you get for God? We want to respond. That's fine. No problem at all with that. That's what we do. My problem is when an apologist has already come to the conclusion that they want to draw and then creates whatever rational stream they need to get there, because that kind of rationalization easily becomes, well, that. It becomes rationalization. It becomes us just laying down arguments until the people on the other side are finally just giving up because they're just tired of trying to oppose it. Not necessarily because we actually spoke the truth. We just have to be careful not to go down that road. Use reasoning, not rationalization. And so the question would follow this way in terms of politics right now. And the question originally was, are you starting with the result you want and then finding your way to a reason for it, finding your way to justification for it? And so I would ask you this question in order for you to ask yourself that question. Why do you trust the news reports you believe instead of the ones you reject? And if the answer is because they are reporting on the news the way I want to hear it, then we're already gone. We're already just rationalizing. We're just finding the evidence we like and then stopping right there and holding on to the evidence we agree with. And when something else comes out, we just say, well, obviously that's not true because it doesn't come to the conclusion that I want to draw. That's poor reasoning. And it doesn't mean that you're wrong on your side of the argument. But it does mean you've gone to rationalizing and you don't have good justification for the conclusions you're drawing. And that means it's time for us to rethink why we're willing to trust the news reports we believe and rejecting the ones we reject. I had one of these conversations by email with somebody one time about the issue of immigration, and I had a different opinion. I have a different opinion than a lot of people do on that. I'm more libertarian in my thinking about it. I like for the economy to drive whatever happens with immigration. I don't think it's evil for a person to say we should have strong borders and we should have clearly defined boundaries and that we should have a just practice of immigration. Obviously, we don't quite have that. We don't even nearly have it right now. But we could get there in different ways. I understand. So I was having this discussion, emails flying back and forth, and I'm saying, hey, I think that's probably the wrong approach, and this attitude towards immigrants is different because of this and that. And his response, you know, was one way, and then mine was another way, and we kept going back and forth. He would make his argument, I would make mine. And finally, at a point where I think he either got tired of the argument or he just wanted to prove that he was right no matter what, sent 40-something bullet points. No kidding. I'm not exaggerating. Not one argument, not something he was waiting for a response to. 40-something bullet points to make his point. Well, here are all the reasons. I think he probably copied and pasted it from somewhere. And in that sense, he won, because it's like, well, I'm not going to respond to 40-something bullet points. I have a life and a job, you know? So you just quit at some point. And that's using rationalization, not reasoning. That's a point where you just want the other person to have to quit. So that's number one. Are you starting with the results you want and then finding your way out to a reason to defend it? Secondly, does your rationale also justify behaviors that all of us condemn? Does your rationale, the one that you're using to justify whatever it is that's going on, does it also justify behaviors that all of us know are wrong and would condemn? So, for instance, the non-political example. I hear this one all the time. Well, you know, David had his Abishag. Okay, if you don't know the story, you go read it. I'm not going to tell you the story. I'm not telling you. But it's, you know, an old man, a young woman, a very young woman, that they bring to David to give him life again, right? And so men use this story when they've decided to, you know, these old men have decided to move on. And so they cheat on their wife, they leave their wife, they do whatever it is. And then their followers, instead of saying, wow, you know, something's wrong here, we need to address this, they say, well, you know, David had Abishag. And it's disconcerting, the contexts in which I have heard that statement. Not the least of which is that she didn't do him any good. You know, that wasn't exactly as helpful as they thought it was going to be. But it also, you know, justifies things we don't try to justify as a society. All of us, we know we're not trying to justify that. Well, here's the one that is a little bit political. And it just crushes me when I hear this. And because I will tell you, I wrote part of my dissertation. My dissertation's about moral atrocities in the mid-20th century. And part of my dissertation was about the Holocaust. And part of the Holocaust's stain is that people looked back on the Jews who cooperated with their Nazi harassers, who were kind, and those who also resisted. And they would say to them, if everyone had just cooperated, none of this would have happened. You know, if the Jews had just found their way to a different place, if they just hadn't, they brought it on themselves. It's the ultimate form of victim blaming. If they would just cooperate, they wouldn't have been shot. And the reality is that's not true at all. The reality is that when the Jews cooperated, they were treated even more bestially. They were treated as if they had no value whatsoever and wouldn't even stand up for themselves. So why don't we just kill them all? It didn't matter what they did. They weren't causing the problems that came on them. That's victim blaming, and that's obviously wrong. All of us should condemn that. And yet I hear it now. I hear it about things that we wouldn't want to say ought to be the case. We don't believe that those who are armed in defense of the government and our laws, who we care about and who are important, first responders are important. And it's important the work they do to maintain the rule of law in our society. I value all of that. And yet I know they can't just stop someone and tell them to do anything they want. Get on your knees right now. And then if you don't get on your knees, they get to shoot you in the head. If those victims would only cooperate, we shouldn't be rationalizing that way. And I've heard a lot of it. We should know better. We should know enough history to know that doesn't work. That's not true. That when that type of force is being used, you don't need to blame the victim for what happened. What we should recognize is that those who are in authority have a responsibility to resolve things in the best way that they can, not simply to say, the victim didn't cooperate, so I get to do whatever I want. We can't blame the victims. When we start doing that, we're going to be going down the road we learned we should not go down 70 years ago. So a little history is always helpful, right? Next question, if you're still with me, and I hope you are. Look, you know, considering our own reasoning is difficult and painful sometimes, but it's worth doing. So here are the other questions I want to give you. I'll give them to you quickly. Does your rationale justify actions you would reject if conversely applied to you? Does your rationale, I think it's just fine because this and that and this and that. If you were to turn that around to yourself, they can do that to me too. Would you still be saying it? Would you still be thinking it? I remember when I would stand outside of people's doors and scream the gospel at them through their door. And then I remember sitting at a DART station with my family and some guy screaming the gospel at everybody at the DART station and thinking to myself, I hope he doesn't have a gun. Because he was the scariest person at the DART station. Now, I'm not against evangelism. I'm for evangelism. I'm all for it. But that kind of aggressive evangelism that we think is the message of a prophet, you know, isn't something that sounds so great when somebody's practicing it with you and discounting the trust they ought to earn with you in order to be able to tell you that kind of good news. So justification for entering into people's homes without a warrant, which is, you know, it's one of the basic rights in the Bill of Rights at the end of the Constitution, right? I mean, that's the point. So entering a person's home without a warrant, they deserve it. We got to straighten things. We got to have law and order. Yeah, but what about when they come to your house and they have a right now to enter your house without having a warrant just because they want to come in, look around, see what they can find? Are you seriously okay with that? Nah, we're not. We're not okay with it. Why are we rationalizing it when it happens to other people then? Because we don't like the other people. That's not consistent. Can't do that. Because the next administration is not going to like us. And we need to figure out how we're going to think rationally, not just rationalize our thinking. In the same way, are you making an exception for something you would normally consider foundational? Like, no exceptions to this. This is the rule. This is basic to our way of living. And look, on this one, faith is a serious challenge for us. It's difficult for us because we freely, and I mean believers, those of us who have faith in Christ, we We condemn people all the time for their irrational beliefs. They believe in ridiculous things, and we make fun of them for it. And then we here's an example. We condemn people for irrational beliefs, but then we turn around and we celebrate the irrationality of the Trinity or the Incarnation. And I've talked about those things in the past, and I believe them. Don't wonder about that. I absolutely believe them. Conversely, if you want to put it the opposite way, we celebrate academic credentials. No. You say, I don't trust higher education. No. I've read it. I've seen it too many times. This man who agrees with everything we believe. I mean, from C.S. Lewis to whoever you want to pick. They're a theologian from Oxford. This one's from Harvard. And he agrees with all we... Listen to him speak to it. We love those credentials when they're for us, but then dismiss the credentials or education as a practice entirely as if it's evil because its proponent or representative speaks against our already held beliefs. That's not rational. That's rationalizing. You can't trust higher ed, but this guy from Harvard will tell you why you can't trust it. That doesn't make sense. In the same way, I think I, hear too much right now of us excusing the idea of absolute power, of giving away, ceding power to the government authorities. The concept that was foundational for the people I'm around all the time was an awareness that power corrupts. Thomas Jefferson's line, that government is best which governs least. Oh, but our government, it should be able to do whatever it wants without any restrictions whatsoever. That's saying you're making an exception for something that's supposed to be foundational to our beliefs. The famous quote from Lord Acton, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, even when they exercise influence and not authority. That line condemns the idea that we can just trust someone with absolute power and it's all going to come out okay. We always know that until our guy is the one with power. And then we're like, no, I think it's okay right now. I think we can get by with it right now. Now, look, the implication of this one, this particular example of power corrupting, should be this. If you have more power and more influence, then you should face more accountability and more judgment. That's the point in James 3:1. That's the whole point. Not many of you should want to be teachers. Don't all of you want to be a bunch of teachers? Because teachers face the greater judgment. When you take on responsibilities, when you take on power, when you take on the load of leading others, you also take on the judgment that comes with it, meaning the accountability that comes with it. And that applies to my area. I teach, I preach, I'm sitting here doing a podcast knowing that I will answer to God for every word that I speak, and don't think it doesn't matter to me. It matters to me every single time. I know in higher education, the things, and I'm winding it up, the things that we do, that I say in the classroom, they can have a great sway on young minds. I get that. And because of that, it makes perfect sense for people to hold me, to hold us as a school accountable for how we exercise that sway. Absolutely. But the accountability has to be based on something other than just another absolute power. It has to be moral. Otherwise, it just becomes a different source of abusive and unaccountable power being exercised. That's what's happening in public higher education right now. A new governor gets elected somewhere, and they replace the members of the board for this school, the governing board for this school, and suddenly all these professors are getting fired because they don't teach what we want them to teach. And we're abusing power and then justifying it on the basis that we have it. We should know that's inconsistent with the very basics that we have always held in the past, an awareness that power corrupts and that we have to be very cautious about willing to give it to anyone in any kind of expression. Okay, so what's my point for the day? We very often bury the things that we just don't want to have to think about. So, for instance, we just avoid the news altogether. When the news is just so heavy that we can't carry it. I do that a lot of times. I just can't listen to this anymore. We do the same thing with our own ideas. Sometimes we just can't accept that we could be the problem, that we could be the evil instead of the solution, the good that we thought we were. Sometimes we just can't bear that. And so we bury it under our rationalization. Sometimes we take our nagging doubts about ourselves, which are healthy. You need those because they make you think more sharply. They make you examine those little dark corners that you had left behind. So we take those nagging doubts, unfortunately, we take our active conscience, the gift that God gave us, and we smother it under shoveled layers of avoidance and or rationalization. But sometimes, and this is what I'm hoping for, the conscience is not quite dead. It's not quite dead yet, you know. It wriggles a finger back up through the soil to where it can just niggle at the soles of our feet, or more literally, our souls. And it screams out. I mean, it's saying from under the dirt that we buried it under, pay attention to me. You know better than this. It's all there. But what we hear is nothing more than just this slight pause before we think of how to address that question that almost knocked us off our game, that took us off the party line. That we think, you know, what we hear is that we have to find a patch to cover what we know is a gap in our thinking. I'm advocating for us digging up the grave we threw our conscience into. And we can find all kinds of things there that God thought were important when he created and commanded us. We'll find all kinds of things. We've thrown them in the bottom, and we've covered them up, and we've ignored them for a while, but they're still there. And I do mean all that stuff that gets mocked so often, but is the core of Christianity, whether we like it or not, love, empathy, mercy, kindness, even just plain old faith. Not the kind of faith that demands unanimity, agreement, irrational acquiescence, but the kind that comports with the rest of the truth, all of which we remember is God's, even the parts we'd like to explain away. But there they are, and there they are, and there they are. So here's the truth, the whole truth, God's truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp. Wonder, wonder, wonder.